Things you enjoy like Charlotte Talks will always be here for you and for our community. And by giving now, you'll help keep the fund drive short on WFAE. The goal is to raise $400,000. That's it. With as little fundraising as possible. So that means that as soon as we hit that goal, we'll go back to uninterrupted Charlotte Talks, which I'm sure you'll appreciate. Now, you can do your part by contributing now and calling 704-549-9000, or you can give online at WFAE.org. Joining me now is Tina Simmons.
Good morning, Kim. You know, there are just some things that always go together. For instance, that second cup of coffee and the great engaging conversations that you hear on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Well, remember, membership contributions keeps you informed by keeping award-winning programming on the air here at WFAE. And your continuing support has never been more important than it is now. So keep the news and the coffee flowing by calling 704-549-9000 with your pledge.
You know, that coffee and that news has never been so important as it is now in a time of tremendous change. So if you are looking to us to keep you informed with in-depth coverage, call us. Call us with your pledge of support. It's very easy. 704-549-9000. Or again, if you're shy, you can go on to WFAE.org. Either way, we would appreciate anything that you have to give, and we thank you for your support.
Thanks a lot.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Fuzzle Shake is an artist, activist, author, and photographer who set out 7 years ago to help people around the world to better understand human rights issues. He decided that reaching the widest possible audience would require a non-traditional approach to publishing and distribution. He also understands that bringing a camera into a situation requires time and trust before that camera can capture the truth. Much of his work has been with displaced people driven out of their homelands by civil wars, drought, and famine, people who have sometimes spent years in refugee camps. His photographs aren't shocking or overly dramatic. On the contrary, they are contemplative and respectful, and therein lies their power. An exhibit of Fuzzel Sheikh's work opens tonight at the Van Every Smith Galleries at Davidson College and will be on display there through December 19th. Fuzzel Sheikh joins us this hour to talk about that exhibit, his work in general, and human rights issues around the world. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. You've been photographing, as I said, refugee communities and people who are in less fortunate circumstances than everybody listening to us this morning. Mm-hmm. How and why did you start?
Well, it's a bit curious. I was born and raised in New York City, but from a mixed parentage. My father was from Kenya of Indian descent, and my mother was from the States. And soon after graduating from college, I was given a fellowship to go back to Kenya and to work on the border where my father's family was from. But in that same year, 500,000 refugees had flooded into the country from the north. It was 1992, and Sudan, Ethiopia, and Somalia were in great turmoil. And so it seemed to me, since this was the most sort of pressing issue for the country at the time, that it might be interesting to visit one of the camps to see if there was a way to speak about what was going on, to document the situation. And in a way, it's this single experience of this first visit that sort of touched off an inquiry which has continued ever since.
So what were you planning to do when you went there? Had this not happened, what were you planning to...
Well, I would have documented actually the Swahili communities, where I had spent much of my childhood. We would go back and forth during the vacation times away from school we spent in Kenya. But and certainly, I presume a Fulbright would not have been given to someone who was interested in an inquiry into the refugee issue. Mm-hmm. But as I said, that was sort of the main thrust of the fellowship, was to address issues that the country was facing in the moment, and it seemed to me that was the appropriate inquiry.
Do you think I called you an artist, a photographer, activist, an author. How do you think of yourself?
Well, the thing I always am sort of troubled by is this notion that people seem to want to compartmentalize one who is working, let us say, with photography or whatever it may be, as an artist or a documentarian or a writer. And I think, you know, if work is strong enough, it can fill in several niches at the same time and kind of create links across these boundaries. So, I mean, I'm comfortable with the notion of artist, photographer, documentary.
Because they say a picture is worth a thousand words,
yeah.
And yet you accompany your photographs, at least in the books, and I'm assuming at the exhibit that opens tonight, there's a lot of text that accompanies
yes.
the photographs. Mm. Why do you need the words?
Well, it's interesting because I think the photographs do some things extremely well. They set the stage. They invite the viewer, entice the viewer, perhaps. But I'm not one who believes that a photograph can do everything. And I found that the situations I was documenting required some kind of broader contextualization of the story. Often it's a text that's about my own heritage or my own relationship to the place. And other times, more frequently in recent projects, it's the testimonials of the individuals.
When you first went into these refugee camps, I read, and this may not be accurate, but I read this, you spent time before photographing these people, just looking around, talking to them, getting to know them, gaining their trust. In one case, I believe you even asked one of the elders in the camp, and I don't know that there's any particular structured hierarchy that mm-hmm. in these camps, but an older person, if it would be all right to take photographs, and he seemed a little shocked that you would even deign to ask him that question. What was the point of waiting, and how does that inform the photographs, gaining these people's trusts?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. If I may offer an anecdote, it was the first trip, in fact, to the Sudanese border that mm-hmm. this story comes from. And it was during a time where there were about 25,000 refugees who had come in from the Sudan. And I gained permission to travel to the camp with the UN, but realized on arrival that those with whom I was traveling were immediately setting about their projects in the camp and leaving in the afternoon on the return flight to Nairobi. So there was no time to let your preconceptions fade away and to establish a kind of understanding of what your own sense of the place might be. And I remember feeling this incredible sense of sort of vulnerability in one way, that I didn't have the tools to know how to render this place.
Vulnerability in what way?
Vulnerability in the sense that others seem so prepared, so clear about what they wanted from the place. And I, for myself, I was so overwhelmed by what I was seeing, I didn't think that I really understood it well enough to say anything about it, in fact. Mm-hmm. And so my inclination was not to work for some days. And eventually, as you mentioned, I decided perhaps one avenue that might be, let's say, in sync with my own sensibilities would be to ask the village elders themselves. And I asked Deng Dao, who is the head of the community, one afternoon, would he be willing to let me photograph in the community document with his collaboration? And he said to me, "Why are you asking me? I'm only a refugee." But it was clear from that first meeting in the tone of his voice what a trespass it had been for others to move through his society, his community, without ever asking permission. So I soon came to an understanding that this was the best mode, to work slowly in concert with various communities, to ask the elders of the communities what was sort of the salient issues to deal with, and let them instruct the process.
Do you do this wherever you go, and including Beloved Daughters, which is the exhibit that's at Davidson, which concerns itself with women in India?
Yeah, I've sort of learned in a way to embrace that notion of vulnerability at the outset, because I think it implies that you are open to what the place has to offer, rather than approaching a place with a set notion of how you want to render it.
What I find interesting about what I've seen of your work, and I've certainly seen only a little tiny snippet of it, but what I find interesting about it is you are not operating in anything approaching the method of a photojournalist.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really trying to capture these people in their environment as much as you are trying to capture the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You've really pared it down to the people, and how you don't even know if you didn't know what circumstances they were in, you may not know what circumstances they were in.
Hmm.
Why?
Well, I mean, I was initially pretty troubled by the way in which the media, or in the case perhaps of Somalia, the way in which I'd seen those communities rendered in New York and the New York Times, the notion of single people, victims of a kind of cruel and aggressive world, never the notion that they might be bolstered by a broader community. And so I determined early on that I wasn't really interested in the realm of photojournalism or even, sadly to say, to work with the media, that I was more interested in spending time and creating, as you allude to, these sort of formal portraits and the voices then that provide a broader context. Sometimes there are images of the place situating the story, and in other instances it's more the portrait and the kind of gaze of the sitter that entices you to want to know more.
Why do these people who come, who are almost universally in horrible situations, some of them in refugee camps, others are cast-off widows in India, which we'll talk about, that's the subject of the exhibit at Davidson, why would they want to be photographed, and why wouldn't they feel that they are being used or manipulated for your greater good as opposed to their greater good?
Yeah, it depends, of course, on the community, but for the most part, when you ask a kind of collaborative relationship, they really believe that it's important that somebody sort of document what they see, what they feel about their place. I mean, in many instances, they have people moving through the community never being very interested in their own history. And you must remember as well that perhaps if we take Sudan and Somalia as examples, that the media was flooding into those places during the moment of great exodus. But these are communities that have sustained themselves in exile for, you know, more than 15 years. So often I sort of see it and suggest it to them as a kind of a document of that time in history.
Fazal Sheikh, who is a photographer, author, etc., humanitarian, activist, is our guest today. His exhibit, Beloved Daughters, opens tonight at Davidson College.
Thanks, Mike. You're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. Programming funded this morning by Providence Day School, hosting an admissions open house Monday, October 20th at 7 p.m. for grades TK through 12. Information at providenceday.org. And by Taylor Richardson Conger and TRCW, specializing in made-to-measure clothing for men and women, garments designed and tailored to individual specifications. Locations in Charlotte and Lake Norman. TRCstyle.com. WFAE would like to provide you with a companion to your news listening. A 6-month subscription to Newsweek magazine is yours when you make a pledge at any amount on your credit card during this pledge drive. Your subscription will begin in January, just as a new administration comes to Washington. You'll receive Newsweek in addition to any other thank you gift you qualify for when you make a pledge using your credit card by calling 704-549-9000 or pledging online at WFAE.org. Thanks. And thank you for tuning in this morning, listening to the Conversations on Charlotte Talks. I'm Tina Simmons, along with Kim Watson Brooks, welcoming you to the WFAE Fall Fund Drive. Our goal is simple this morning, to raise as much money as we can to pay for the great local, national, and international reporting and analysis you hear on WFAE. Pay for it in as little time as possible. So please support the programs that you value and keep WFAE's fund drives short by calling 704-549-9000. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Tina. You know, it's interesting listening to Charlotte Talks. One of the points Mike and Fazal brought up is the fact that Fazal had to gain the trust of the people he photographed in order to get the best story. Any great relationship includes trust, and that defines the relationship we have with you, the listener. Trust. You trust that what you hear on WFAE is accurate, has in-depth coverage, and we trust that you'll support it with your contribution. Now, the funding model for public radio is and always has been a reliance on the voluntary support of our listeners. That's you. You ensure that the future of WFAE with your pledge of support is viable. So please call now. 704-549-9000 is the number to call. We have some wonderful volunteers here waiting to take your call. And in fact, Brugger's University Area Bagels has given us food to keep our volunteers strong and ready to take those calls. So thank you to them. 704-549-9000 is the number to call, or WFAE.org.
You know, with so many news outlets to choose from, we're proud that WFAE is still your number one source when it comes to learning about what's important and what's going on in our world. You found that WFAE provides dependable, in-depth coverage of the election, the economy, and the arts. And since you've chosen to listen to WFAE for the news, we're asking you to contribute by making a pledge this morning. Since we're a public radio station, we rely on contributions from listeners, not commercials, not the government, to pay for all of the extraordinary programs you hear on WFAE. So please call right now with your pledge, 704-549-9000, and maybe you'll think about coming on board at that $52 level this morning.
If you come on board at that $52 level, we will give you the 2009 NPR calendar. Now, it's the fifth year, and the NPR calendar series features artwork from renowned graphic illustrators. It's a wonderful piece, and all you have to do is call in with your pledge of support to 704-549-9000. Now, you want a complete understanding of what's behind the issues in the news, so you seek out fair-minded and thorough sources of news and information. You're busy, you rely on WFAE for its in-depth coverage, as well as its portability, meaning you can take it anywhere with you.
Absolutely.
You can take it anywhere. You can take it to the gym, you can take it, you can get the information in your car, at your place of business. And we're still deepening your understanding of the world. Well, we need you in order to continue doing that. And all you have to do is make a quick call to 704-549-9000 or log on to WFAE.org.
We're asking all listeners of WFAE to call in with a contribution this morning. As we get back to the discussion on Charlotte Talks, the phone lines are open, waiting for you. 704-549-9000. And you can always make a secure pledge on our website, WFAE.org. Thank you.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Fazil Sheikh, a photographer. His exhibit, Beloved Daughters. Let me be clear about this, because evidently I got it wrong a second ago. His exhibit opens tonight, December 16th, with a reception from 7 to 9, and then it opens fully, although if that's open to the public, it opens fully to the public on the 17th of October 2008 and runs to the 19th at the Van Every Smith Galleries at Davidson College. You can get more information at davidson.edu or at fazalsheikh.org, F-A-Z-A-L-S-H-E-I-K-H. We'll put up some links on our website to make that a little bit easier. In reading about your work in Africa and Afghanistan and elsewhere, critics have written that it almost has a religious tone about it, and that in your work one detects a definite sympathy for the subject, actually a reverence, and actually it would be hard to understand how that could not be the case given where you've been and the conditions that these folks are in. But once again, you're not working as a photojournalist because you feel that they're not telling the whole story here. So your images evoke this kind of calmness, this quietness in the midst of the storm, and you pare it down to the bare essentials. So as a viewer of these photographs, what then do we take away?
Well, I think what's curious about the work or the endeavor is that I would like to make a body of work that it doesn't reject that which we read or see in the media, but it rather provides a kind of counterbalance that when one reads a piece in the Times or so and sees the images, they might also conjure the moment when they saw another kind of rendering of that community. You know, and I think those kinds of renderings do some things extremely well, things which my own work probably don't do so well, you know, for instance, to garner funds for communities. And I think essentially I came to the belief that it isn't really about financial difference, monetary difference, which is implying a hierarchical relationship anyway. It's about offering the possibility that the people before you, that we might very well be in the same situation, and that for me is important.
Well, it is said that your photographs implicitly assert that the individual refugees that you photograph share humanity with their oppressive leaders, mm-hmm. that they are one and the same, that mm-hmm. if the tables were turned, it could be the other way
mm-hmm.
around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very easy for us sitting here to distance ourselves from the notion of what extreme hardship might bring, mm-hmm. you know, and our capacity for kindness, for violence, aggression, is probably much broader than we like, you know, than we like to confront. And so I think in the places I've worked, I see people who their lives have encompassed a whole wide range of experience, which I really must say I relate to. You know, I think on a fundamental emotional level is something that I feel somehow connected to.
Well, as I sit here and talk to you, you are very even-toned, very calm, very peaceful. And the things that you have seen, I would assume, have a tendency to make a person angry, frustrated. But you don't carry any of that with you anywhere? It's not coming through in this conversation.
Well, I mean, personally, I think my greatest period of upset was, as I said before, after September 11th, because yeah. I had spent so much time making work, bringing it back home here to the States in the hope of, you know, weaving bonds across communities, religions, societies and nations. And I felt like that was such, that there was such a rift, you know, this cavern that was going to be very difficult to bridge in some regard. So that was, from my perspective, if I hadn't had the opportunity to work in a more productive way during that time, I think I would have been very angered.
And much of the people, much of the work that you have on display in your books and that you've worked on deals with people who have been discriminated against for one reason or another, through no fault of their own. And 9/11 put you in that precarious situation because of your background and because of your name. I'm not sure that I have a question here, but I see the interconnectedness of this, that it would have been very easy for you to find yourself in a difficult situation because of your name and mm-hmm. your work and where you've been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Coming back from Afghanistan with a name like Fazal Sheikh, back to New York City, given the Patriot Act, could have been difficult, right?
Arriving with stamps from Somalia, Sudan.
So does that give you a kind of kinship with the people you photograph?
I think it's necessary for all of us to have a kind of kinship with the people in those images. And I think that holds the potential for healing, you know, across societies and also offers the possibility to forestall aggression in the future. And that's, I think that kind of belief is perhaps what sustains me, you know. Mm. It's much more interesting for me to invest myself in something that I hope, you can't measure the tangible impact, but you hope that it has a positive role in the world. And that's, for me, is much preferable to focus on a hopeful solution rather than an aggressive one.
In the places that you've been and in the situations that you've taken your camera and decided to use it, I would think you would be overwhelmed by what's surrounding you and the numbers of people surrounding you. So how do you decide who to photograph and in what situation to photograph them and in how to pose them? Because mm-hmm. a lot of this is portraiture.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make those decisions?
It's a difficult question. I mean, I think that each time I arrive in a place, I'm open to what they're going to offer. And I think I have the tools. You know, I think I've done it long enough that I will be able to find my way, but I'm open to shifting that trajectory. And some of the situations are very difficult to endure. And usually during those moments, I don't photograph. You know, I don't see much heroism in going to a place for a short time that's volatile, coming away with a cache of imagery and then, you know, speaking about the heroism of having been there. I think it's much more heroic to live year in and year out in a place like they do. You know, and that's a very kind of macho perspective, that you go in into a war zone and you bring back these images to save the world.
Yes.
Fact be known, I really don't know what my images do. You know, I do, as I said, really hope that they subtly affect people's perception.
But you have to make a decision about what you want the image to be, who you want it to be of, and what mm-hmm. you want it to be. So how How do you arrive at that decision?
Well, I'm generally choosing projects that are less attended to by others, those which somehow strike a chord within me and about issues that I either, you know, am connected to or find somehow inspiring. And then, as I said, it's collaborative. Mm-hmm. I know that I want to try and get to the essence of the place, and often that has a political base, which is the starting point, and then asking the people how to begin to articulate that.
You, I'm curious about the equipment that you use, because I know that I saw one photograph that was a Polaroid, and I know that you have a series of photographs with the elders in Afghanistan that were taken by a single gas lamp light, which are stunning photographs. And I'm just curious about, and I know we have photographers who listen, just to get technical for a second, what equipment that you use?
I'm actually not very technically adept. I use very simple older cameras. I've used a Polaroid camera, a Rolleiflex camera that was made before I was born. I really believe that it's much less important the material you use than what it is you have to say. And when you know something about what you want to say, you find simple equipment to render it in the appropriate fashion.
Mm. You didn't mention digital.
No.
And you shouldn't
black
and
goodness.
White.
Thank goodness. Yeah, I do.
Why black and white?
For me, it really kind of pairs down the image. It makes it more contemplative, and it cuts to the essence. You know, you mentioned the portraits of the Afghan elders by lamplight, and for my sensibility, it's sort of the landscape of their faces were etched with the kind of loss of their hopes of the past, you know, what the Mujahideen movement was meant to bring to their country, and this kind of disillusion when it failed. And so for me, black and white, in a way, I think I also see and feel things more in black and white. It's about cutting things down to their essence.
Do you do your own printing, or does that you leave that to somebody
else? I do. Until the last few years, I became sensitized to the chemistry, and now actually the rendering is turning in that to make a physical print, to utter the D word, digital, is actually not such a bad thing. To make it once the traditional negative in a simple fashion, and then to render it, I render them now as carbon prints and darkroom prints both.
You spent time, as we said, in Afghanistan. You produced a book about that called The Victor Weeps. Was that before or after the Soviet invasion? Was it before or after the Taliban?
It was during the rise of the Taliban from 96 to 98.
Why did they have a reputation, justifiably, for being repressive and suspicious.
Yeah.
Why did they let you in?
Well, when I have a long beard and long hair, I look rather Afghan. So as long as I didn't say anything when I was in public transport or so, I pass as an Afghan.
What if they addressed you? Because you don't speak Pashtun,
No.
You don't speak Farsi?
I never really had any trouble, but I was traveling, as I said, with my companion Abdul Sattar, and remained rather mute during those moments.
Well, how would they have regarded you? Had they known you were there, or did they know you were there, and did they know what you were doing when they found out that you were there?
No, none of the Taliban knew. I mean, there were people in the upper echelon of the government at the time that Abdul Sattar knew and with whom I met in private, but no, on an official basis, never.
Given the repression of that era in Afghanistan, how did you gain the confidence of the people that you actually photographed? Well, I mean, would they have been in trouble had the Taliban discovered that you had a camera and that you were taking pictures? And
well, the notion of making of taking photographs would certainly have been a problem.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, a portion of the book relates an encounter I had at a photo studio one evening in Jalalabad, where we entered this rundown building, which had been a former photo studio, and of course, as you know, renderings of any human form were forbidden during that time. And kind of as an act of defiance, the man who owned the shop gave me all of these negatives. And in the book, I talk about looking through those negatives that night and kind of ruminating, you know, what had happened to these people's lives? Where were they? Why were their pictures, you know, left in this place? And what is photography, you know, what does it mean to try and document a place? The times where I couldn't photograph, then here I could use the written elements to fill in the gaps.
It's one thing to go to a refugee camp in Africa and to go to India and photograph widows and young girls and talk about the condition of women's rights in India. It's another, it seems to me, to go into a war zone or to go into an area where you know you're not welcomed by the leadership, because it puts you in personal danger. What goes through your head?
I mean, I was welcomed by most of the civilians I met. But, this notion, I kind of alluded to it before, you know, the idea of thrusting yourself into a volatile situation. I'm not sure that that's always something that I'm after. In fact, it's really not. Most of my work has been about communities after that initial surge of interest, you know, and sometimes it's about the enduring effects, the legacy of war as held within the psyche of the people. And so,
but you're still in personal danger. If the Taliban had found
the two places I worked that were at times rather volatile were Afghanistan and Somalia, the Somali border camps. But that was not, you know, that's not something that really interests me, the idea of putting yourself in some harm's way as a heroic act. I don't see that. I just feel that at times, to really understand the depths and the complexity of an issue, it's necessary to visit and to see firsthand what those things mean.
You're recognized in the world of photography as somewhat being a genius. What prepared you for what you do, either as a photographer, in other words, what kind of training have you had as a photographer, but mm-hmm. also in the subject matter that attracts you and the stories that you tell through your work? What in life prepared you for this life that you're leading now?
Oh, that's a good question. I think in some ways I learned... important question.
It happens every once in a while. So he's silent.
I think in some ways I learned that the process of photography, from very early on, I never saw a document of a place as being an objective rendering of a reality. So if I'm going to bear a story forward, it's expected that it's going to be filtered through my own sensibilities. And so I use the process in a way to engage, I don't like to put it that way, but to engage facets of myself or own inquiries into my own feelings about places or connections mm-hmm. to places. And this is something I learned at university, actually studying with Emmett Gowan, was that the process was what was important. That if you were rendering something that you really cared about, that's what would be born forth in the final image. And I think that that's really true.
Fazal Sheikh is our guest this morning on WFAE.
Thanks, Mike. We'll get back to Charlotte Talks in just a moment here at WFAE. Programming this morning is funded by Womble Carlyle Sandwich and Rice, helping businesses with legal solutions for over a century. Womble Carlyle, innovators at law. Details available at WCSR.com. And by Catawba Science Center, inviting families with children ages 2 to 7 to explore concepts of construction, motion, and simple machines during Little Builders, now through January 4th. Details at CatawbaScience.org. Today until 6 p.m., your pledge at 704-549-9000 or WFAE.org will enter you into a drawing for one of 10 Radiosophy HD radios. With an HD radio, you'll be able to listen to the 3 digital radio signals that WFAE now offers: the simultaneous broadcast of the news and information channel you're tuned to now, the new All Jazz service, and the eclectic Exponential music channel. These sleek design tabletop models come complete with an alarm, an MP3 port, and great digital sound. No pledge is necessary to enter, but we know you'll want to support all that WFAE does for you. 704-549-9000 or WFAE.org. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Kim Watson-Brooks, and this is our fall membership campaign. Now, listeners are WFAE's most important source of income. Giving now to 704-549-9000 keeps programs such as Charlotte Talks on the air, and it helps us meet our goal of keeping on-air fundraising to a minimum. Now, here's Here's Tina Simmons with details on how you can make a difference.
Well, good morning, Kim, and thank you for tuning in Charlotte Talks this morning. We're going to get back to the discussion in just a moment. Hope you find that WFAE informs you about events in our region and the world. Well, support the things that make your life more meaningful. Call right now with your pledge to keep WFAE strong. Your call to 704-549-9000. Well, it'll make sure that we have all the resources we need to bring you the news and information you need. So here's the number, 704-549-9000. Your pledge in any amount will make a big difference here at WFAE.
Now, public radio introduces you to people and ideas that you would have otherwise not met. Now, it's interesting to listen to Mr. Fazil Sheikh, who says, to understand the depth and complexities of a place, it's important to visit to see it firsthand. Now, if you can't do that, isn't it wonderful that you have a station like WFAE who lets you do it through a person like Fazil Sheikh? Well, if you value that, then we're asking you to put a little back in just to support it. We're big on giving you the, gee, I never saw it that way reaction. Refugees share in humanity with their oppressors. You heard Mr. Fazil Sheikh say it. And that's something that you'll only hear on a station like WFAE. We dig into the complexities of the world and humanity at large, and all we're asking is for you to call with your pledge of support so we can keep that going. 704-549-9000 is the number to call, or WFAE.org.
Supporting WFAE today, one of the best things you can do with just 2 minutes of your time this morning. By taking 2 minutes to make your contribution, you keep WFAE on the air for you and the community. So together, let's get it done this morning, 704-549-9000. And as we get back to Charlotte Talks, you can also make a secure pledge on our website this morning at WFAE.org. Thank you for listening this morning, and thanks in advance for your support.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Fazil Sheikh, a photographer, artist, writer, and he has several books to his credit. Also has an exhibit opening tonight, October 16th, 2008, at the Van Every Smith Galleries at Davidson College, called Beloved Daughters, which focuses on his work, which took place in India. It's actually a two-part work, and there are two books that you deal with this. One's called Moksha, and the other is Ladli. Moksha means heaven, and Ladli, as I understand, means beloved daughter. And this exhibit really focuses on the second part of that. For this, you went, I'm going to say this wrong, I'm sure, to the holy city of Vrindavan?
Yeah, that's not bad.
In northern India. Talk about this place and the women who inhabited it.
Well, actually, the exhibition, just to elaborate that in that moment, Beloved Daughters is actually kind of about these companion volumes, the first of which you mentioned, Moksha, which means heaven. Mm-hmm. I read several years ago when I was working on another project a small piece about this town, Vrindavan, in North India, to which widows were migrating when they lost their husbands. And I sort of determined it was fascinating, the notion that there were thousands of these widows living in this small town. And so I decided to make one initial journey to see for myself what it was like for them. And the reason that they traveled to Vrindavan, it's a holy city within India, and it's believed to be the playgrounds of Krishna. Now, quite fascinating.
He's the youngest of the gods?
Yes.
The Hindu gods?
And the images that we see often in Indian miniatures of Krishna surrounded by his gopis, his harem, are from actually the forested region around the river Yamuna at Vrindavan. And so the widows migrate to this town believing that if they live out their lives in service to their Krishna, who becomes in essence their father, husband, and son, that he will in turn grant them moksha, or, as you may know, it's freedom from the cycle of death and rebirth.
Freedom from reincarnation, just being dead.
Correct,
and not
heaven,
coming back.
To get to heaven, which is the aspiration of Hindus.
It's fascinating. We're going to find out in the course of this next few minutes exactly what happens to these widows and why. But you just said that they dedicate themselves to this male god who becomes their father, their husband, their sons. And they have been so miserably treated by their fathers, their husbands, and their sons. Why would they embrace a male god?
Well, that's an ironic notion, isn't it? But it should be said that not all of the widows are traveling there strictly because of exploitative practice. Mm-hmm. You know, in India, in the fourth phase of life, the last phase of life, one shall divest themselves of material possessions and wander as an ascetic. So a small percentage of the women in the town actually are from families that are fairly wealthy and would want them to stay with them. So they visit the family, but they always come back to Vrindavan, wanting to live in the town where they can devote themselves completely to Krishna.
But you tell in your book, Moksha, the story of a woman who was married at 12. There's even a story in the book about a woman who was married at 5. Her husband was 12. The marriage was never consummated.
Sarla Gorai.
He died, and she became a widow and an outcast.
Now, this is quite a tragic story in the notion that the widow, even when the marriage was not consummated, is seen as having been responsible for the death of the husband, in essence having brought the bad luck that caused the husband's death.
But this woman who was married at 12 to a much older man gave that man two sons. Mm-hmm. One was described as feeble-minded, but the other was okay, and two unmarried daughters. Her husband died, leaving her to find husbands for the daughters because there's a dowry involved
That's correct.
All of this. Her sons completely abandoned her, and that's just one story of abandonment in this book. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a widow in India, and why are these women who have given birth to sons and daughters abandoned by their children, mm-hmm. and why do they become outcasts simply because their husband passes away?
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's dangerous to make a sweeping generalization of the whole country, but it should be said that, I mean, because also I would want to qualify the book in those terms, you know, that the project is, to step back, is to say that, you know, we should celebrate the fact of India's arrival on the world economic stage. But I think as we do that, this is a moment maybe where we might also reflect on difficult practices that endure in this society and which should be abolished. And so in answer to your question, I mean, the sad thing is that when the husband dies, in essence, what often happens is there's a kind of squabbling for the remnants of what the father has left behind. Often, financially, the people don't want to then support the mother, particularly daughters-in-law. And so great, great pressure is brought to bear on the son, let's say by his wife, to oust the mother-in-law, relieve them of the burden of this woman.
I find this fascinating, and this is a Western point of view, and I understand that they don't think this way over there, and we should not necessarily condemn them for thinking in the way that they think, because they could turn the tables on us and condemn us for the way we think. But if you're a daughter-in-law, and you're encouraging your husband to rid the family of the mother whose husband has died so she won't be a burden on your family, do they not see what might happen to them if their husband dies?
Now, isn't that an ironic notion? It's absolutely the case that in some strange way, there is this great tension. They don't seem to see that in a way, you know, you visit the anger.
Because somebody says in your book, one of the two books, that and I'm going to paraphrase here, that the enemy of women in India is other women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the notion of kind of consolidating your position, there's great fear for loss, for the fragile position you're in as a woman. You know, when you marry, although dowry has officially been prohibited, it still is part of the society. And so when a woman marries a husband, she enters the husband's family and must also bring a dowry for this right. Mm-hmm. So if we take the case of recent stories, there are often squabbles about what, in fact, is being brought by the wife to the husband's family. And this is another source of great strife within the communities, because once the woman enters the husband's family, in essence, her own family gives over the right to deal with her, to defend her. And so she's in a way, she's on her own in that new family.
Very frightening, I would think. Several of the women that you talk to and photograph in the city of Vrindavan, where they have gone to devote themselves to Krishna, say they would like to die or that they are already dead and living with Krishna, which is, to me at least, both profoundly shocking and monstrously sad. And you have been exposed to this many, many, many times over. And when you go there, I suppose you are surrounded by these women. How do you deal with that?
Well, in some way, I kind of relate to that position. I think if you've experienced some degree of emotional trauma in your life, that you in a way are somehow drawn to people who have a similar level of experience, though it may not be the same. And I think I'm also kind of heartened. It is, as you describe it, enormously sad. But I was also at the same time heartened by the kind of sisterhood, the kind of bonds that these women created amongst themselves. You know, they all had similar stories to tell, and often they didn't relate them any longer, save for when I would visit them. And they had kind of put that past behind them and forged this new family amongst the other women, and, as you say, quite surprisingly in some regard, with their god, Krishna, who offered them a degree of hope and promise.
I want to get back to the psychology of this. It just boggles your mind. At least it does mine. I mean, in Ladli, you examine the lives of women throughout the country, and I mean, given what happens to widows in that society, why doesn't this hang like a pall over these women their entire lives? Why would they want to?
I think it does. I think the fear of your husband dying before you do is a pretty upsetting notion for many women in much of India. Even for the sort of the upper class, you know, I have friends who then the mother, let's say, though she's not banished to Vrindavan, she's seen as being inauspicious. So in many cases, a widowed mother wouldn't be at the ceremony, the wedding ceremony of a child, because she would be seen as potentially bringing bad luck upon the union of the children.
Where do these thoughts come from? Does it come from their religious beliefs, from Hinduism, or does it come from just being a long-standing patriarchal society?
Well, I think the notion of this long-standing patriarchal society is the one that troubles me the most, and the one you can speak most clearly about. You know, the stories in those books, not so much Moksha, but Ladli, are about, you know, various communities, Hindu and Muslim alike. So that's not, for me, the real issue. The issue is that there are these enduring cultural practices that continue despite legislation that bans them. So people can turn and say, well, you know, in India, abortion of the fetus is illegal, or dowry has been outlawed, but yet the practice endures. And that's the thing, I think, which is most troubling.
And I think 60 Minutes has done several stories on this over the years, but you mentioned in the book there are several stories of women being horribly mistreated, burned, their children burned in bed, and the husband gets away with it.
Yeah.
You mentioned before we started this conversation, a lack of permission to discuss these matters seems to permeate that society. So as they as India step out into the world stage and becomes a world player, and they certainly will economically.
Yes.
And because of the size of their population, will these things change simply because they become a player on the world stage, because the world's putting pressure on them to change? Should the world get involved in their internal affairs just because we see the world through one lens and they through another? Does it make ours right and theirs wrong? What do you think will happen here? What do you think should happen here?
Well, I think there's little excuse for abuse of human rights, regardless what nation you come from. So I think speaking about that rather directly is important. Interestingly enough, just this year, the Indian premier accepted or spoke publicly for the first time about the incidents of infanticide or fetuside, scanning a sonogram, the pregnant fetus, and when it was found to be a male, aborting it. A Canadian research team...
You mean a female?
Yeah, excuse me, sorry. a Canadian research team found that 500,000 fetuses had been aborted every year for the last 20 years. This means 10 million females had been aborted. Now, it has until now been very difficult to discuss these issues in public in India, to engage in a kind of dialogue. And I'm quite heartened by the notion, whatever the impetus is, I'm not sure, but the notion that at least they're beginning sort of furtive gestures to speak about such enduring practices. But yet they continue. The dowry burnings, the numbers are enormous, as are those of infanticide.
Fazal Sheikh is our guest on WFAE's Charlotte Talks.
Good morning. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, programming funded this morning by NC Green Power, allowing residents and businesses to invest in renewable energy generation through tax-deductible contributions on their electric bills. Information at ncgreenpower.org. And by the Cannon School, where children's love of learning grows each day. Admissions open house for all grades, October 23rd at 7 p.m. Details at cannonschool.org.
NPR News continues to cover the issues of the 2008 election, the wars.
What is happening in Iraq is an ethno-sectarian competition for power and resources.
The economy.
I would call changes necessary in three areas. Taxpayers, they have to come first. Homeowners, we have to do something about the mortgage crisis. And oversight, we need some accountability here.
The campaign.
They're both slinging guilt by association. The McCain ad, the guilt is not real, but the association is plausible. In the Obama ad, the guilt is real, but the association isn't.
Reports on the campaigns and on the issues of the campaigns. Informing sound decisions, NPR News.
Informing sound decisions is exactly what we do here at WFAE. This is the WFAE Fall Fund Drive. I'm Kim Watson Brooks, and the goal of this campaign is quite simple: to get the funding we need to continue bringing you the valued information that you want to hear. And by giving now, you'll help keep this fund drive short. Our goal is to raise $400,000. As soon as we get to that total, it's back to uninterrupted Charlotte Talks, and you can do your part by contributing now. Call 704-549-9000, or you can give online at WFAE.org. Joining me now is Tina Simmons.
Good morning. Many listeners start giving money to WFAE when they recognize that they're listening to this station more than anything else on the radio. And you hear stories and conversations that enrich your lives. Well, you don't hear this kind of news reporting anywhere else. And hope you recognize that your support gives it a home here on WFAE. If you find you're tuning in now more than ever, make your first contribution this morning, 704-549-9000, or pledge online at WFAE.org.
Now, if you call and you pledge at least $52 or more, we'll give you the 2009 NPR calendar. Now it's in its fifth year, and the NPR calendar series features artwork from renowned graphic illustrators, a wonderful gift just by supporting the station that you rely on. And you rely on us because we give you balanced, fair, and informative coverage of the events that affect our lives. Through NPR and our other national and international news sources, we have reporters stationed all over the globe ready to bring you the news on the election, the war in the Middle East, and the economy. Now, through our own newsroom, we have reporters covering all things Charlotte and the region, and to bring you news from our communities means that we need funding from you, and all you have to do is call. 704-549-9000 is the number to call. If you're at work and you want to log on, go to WFAE.org and make your pledge of support there.
Renowned illustrators submitting their visions of public radio. NPR, they've selected 12 of the best of those ideas, and they've put together their 2009 calendar. That's yours this morning at 704-549-9000 when you pledge $52 or more here in support of WFAE. Consider making that pledge this morning on your Visa, MasterCard, or American Express card, or even Discover card, if you will. Your support makes public radio possible, and one of the best things about using that charge card, well, that means more of your contribution goes to work for WFAE by saving us on administrative costs. So please make your pledge this morning and have that credit card ready. Call us at 704-549-9000, or you can charge your pledge on our secure website at WFAE.org.
Now, it's important to note that if you want to call in and give your pledge of support, but you'd like to do it in installments, we'd be more than happy to take that kind of support, too. So please call. Now, your support helps WFAE pay for all of the information that you hear on the station. And while you can't send money directly to NPR to keep Morning Edition or All Things Considered on the air, we can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how public radio works. You give to WFAE when you call 704-549-9000, and we pay NPR for the news you use. With your help, and only with your help, WFAE keeps you connected. Again, the number to call with your contribution is 704-549-9000 or log on to WFAE.org.
We're giving you